So they left the day after Passover, which was when the blood was put on the lintel post, and the children of Israel were actually escorted out, if you will, of Egypt. And it says that it says here in Numbers that it was in the sight of all the Egyptians a picture of the world. You know, the Egyptians being a picture of the world, and they left in the sight of all the Egyptians with boldness, or as King James says, with a high hand. And I don't know exactly what that means, but what I kind of think it means is that I went, see ya. As in, we're not going to go out of here quietly. We're going to leave in your, whether you're looking at us or not. And obviously, the Egyptians were busy doing other things, such as burying their dead. Israel had seen the greatness of God in their life, and they could walk out without fear of retribution, and they went gladly. They were ready to go after 400 years. So my question then is, as I'm reading this, is how often do I walk away that boldly from habits and bondages? Not sneaking away and hoping for the best, but putting my foot forward to trust the Lord. How often do I with high hand say, see ya? Or do I try and work it out in private? Do I try and get a little better, you know, with my sin, or maybe even come to an agreement with it that if it doesn't bother me, I won't bother it? The Lord had already judged the Egyptians and their gods, it says. And in Exodus 7, chapter 7 through 10, it shows how the Lord had judged the gods of the Egyptian. Just so, the world that we live in and its gods have already been judged as well. And they've been convicted. There's an excellent book that goes through the different plagues as it hit Egypt, called The Invisible Man by Donald Gray Barnhouse, that talks about the Egyptian god, each god that was being addressed with each plague. So for a further reading, I would encourage you to pick up that book. It's called The Invisible Man. The Invisible War, not The Invisible Man. The Invisible War by Donald Gray Barnhouse. And my point here is that we too can walk away boldly from that. We can walk away with a high hand, and yet somehow we figure out how to hang on. And then in verses 6 through 49, it begins to take us through the movement of the children of Israel. And inevitably they went to 41 different encampments. So a little more than one per year. And obviously with 2 to 3 million people, that's going to be quite an endeavor. So it wasn't, you know, a matter of moving, you know, from day to day. Sometimes it would take them as much as a day to settle in. So it wasn't a huge amount of movement. However, each time that they moved, of course, they were always following the pillar of fire or the pillar of cloud. So it wasn't like they were wandering. God was taking them. God was taking them. And if we did a study of the names of each one of these places, and since that's not the point of today's study, we won't go through that. But we have done some of that in the past. If we go through that study, there's just an amazing pattern, if you will, of the names of the places where they have visited during those 41 stops. And it shows the education that the Lord was taking them through as He was maturing them in these 41 years and as He was weeding them out over these past 40 years. And it was an education that any proper father would give their children. Growing them up. I mean, there are certain things that we don't give to our children until they're ready. Even though that we know that inevitably they're going to need that skill set. But sometimes they're simply not ready for it. And this is what God was doing, was He was taking them through all these lessons each time so they could eventually go into the promised land. Each stop was a greater opportunity to show them that He loved them and could be trusted to provide for them and lead them. Each stop. Just like we lead our children, according to their age, these children of Israel were being brought along, if you will. So if we jump down to verse 50, it says, Now the Lord spoke to Moses in the plains of Moab by the Jordan across from Jericho, saying, Speak to the children of Israel and say to them, When you have crossed the Jordan into the land of Canaan, then you shall drive out all the inhabitants of the land from before you, destroy all their engraved stones, destroy all their molded images, and demolish all their high places. You shall dispossess the inhabitants of the land and dwell in it, for I have given you the land to possess. And you shall divide the land by lot as an inheritance among your families. To the larger you shall give a larger inheritance, and to the smaller you shall give a smaller inheritance. There everyone's inheritance shall be whatever falls to him by lot. You shall inherit according to the tribes of your fathers. But if you do not drive out the inhabitants of the land from before you, then it shall be that those whom you let remain shall be irritants in your eyes and thorns in your sides, and they shall harass you in the land where you dwell. Moreover, it shall be that I will do to you as I thought to do to them. So in occupying the promised land, the Lord, through Moses, specifies that they're to dispossess the inhabitants. They're to kick them out. Again, telling us that we are to leave no sin unconfronted and destroyed in our own lives. He tells them that they're to remove all idols, all altars and high places. And these high places were places of worship that were actually up in the hills. And engraved stones, it says, or pictures. And this word is alternately interpreted. Sometimes it's imagination, sometimes it's conceits. What it comes down to is these engraved stones are their self-exaltation, or potentially their pornography, potentially their images of their gods. And the Lord says, wipe them out, destroy all of them. This is the reason that Moses reminded them of God's judgment on the gods of Egypt in this very passage, is that he knew that they would soon be facing foreign gods. They would soon be facing these other gods as they walked into the land of Canaan, and they have to decide whether or not they're going to deal with them severely. They have to decide at that point whether or not they're going to deal with them severely. They had just showed themselves very willing to follow the lusts of their own hearts with the Midianite women who were sent in by Balaam. This was not a, you boys be careful out there, kind of warning. God was telling them specifically, you've already, just recently, shown of your capacity for idol worship and sowing to the flesh. So I'm going to tell you again, you will be encountering gods, and they will be attractive. But you must destroy them, all of them. So they have been given the promised land to occupy. And the Lord promised to go out before them to deliver the inhabitants into their hand. But they had to make the decision to drive them out. God was forming with them a divine partnership. He's also going to go before us to deliver the inhabitants of our life, those things that are not in the Spirit. But we have to make the decision to drive them out. He forms with us a divine partnership. I deliver them up, you drive them out. The Lord, when He died, took away our sin, took away the price of our sin. But that act on the cross did not take away our own will and did not take away the things that cause us to walk in the flesh. Those are the things that He addresses. Those are the things that He constantly brings before us, so we can do, as it says here, this divine partnership where He delivers the inhabitants of our life, of our flesh, and we drive them out. In Romans 8:37, it says that we are more than conquerors through Him who loved us. So this is not waiting to know the outcome, but to know victory in the midst of the battle. You don't have to wait to know the outcome because you already know that you're victorious. You will persevere. I will persevere. It cracks me up in professional sports these days when all of a sudden these athletes are guaranteeing wins. You know, well, they're doing that on their own strength. And sometimes it comes true and sometimes it doesn't. Well, obviously, that's not a guarantee that I'm going to take and if I were a betting man, bet money on. I'm just not going to do that. And I certainly wouldn't bet my life on it. But this I can bet my life on. Because God has already told us that the victory is there in the midst of the battle. In the midst of sin, we can already know that the battle is ours. We can know that. Because God is faithful, who will not allow you to be tempted beyond what you can bear, it tells us in 1 Corinthians. We can already know. And again, in Romans 8, it says that we are more than conquerors through Jesus who loved us. So God has called these things the enemy. And the first thing that we have to do is we have to agree with that. We have to agree that what God doesn't like is what we don't like either. That if God calls it wrong, we call it wrong. If God calls it an enemy, we call it an enemy. So God has called these things the enemy. And then we have to agree to eliminate everything associated with this enemy. The sin. We have to agree to eliminate it. And certainly that means attitudes, that means habits, that means vices. Sometimes, unfortunately, that can even mean friends. Sometimes that can even mean family. Does that mean that you cut yourself off from them? No. But what that does mean is that you, and you may have to, but what that does mean certainly is that you have to guard your heart towards those things, towards family, towards friends who are going to lead you into sin. But it will always mean a change of heart. Regardless of what the circumstances, it will always mean a change of heart. When Jesus came and He began to teach the disciples, it says that He did not come to get rid of the law, but to fulfill it. And so in fulfilling the law, well, great. Now we don't have to worry about anything at all. No, He actually raised the standard. Jesus actually raised the standard. And one of the most amazing ones to me, the most amazing examples that he gave was when He talks about the plucking out of the eye. If your eye offends you, pluck it out. If your hand offends you, cut it off. Well, what that essentially means is that we would be a bunch of blind, stumpy people with hearts still full of sin. Because it's a heart issue. He wasn't saying if the eye is bad to rip it out or to cut off the hand simply for self-mutilation, because I guarantee you that if my problem is striking you, if my problem is anger, then if I cut off my hand, then I'll probably beat you with a bloody stump. The issue is the heart. If I'm not willing to change my heart, then I'm still going to be in sin. So we have to agree to eliminate everything associated with that sin, with that enemy. But oftentimes we'll use liberty as an excuse and grace as a hall pass. You know, I don't know about you, but you know, you're in a crowd and somebody will come through as they're pushing you aside saying, "Excuse me, excuse me, excuse me." Well, the "excuse me" I think was as you're stepping back and you're letting them know that you're there so they can move so you can pass. But very often, you know, as a 4-year-old, they're still trying to get used to the concept. But sometimes as a 40-year-old, they still don't get used to the concept. And we often use grace that same way, that as a way to say, well, you know what, I screwed up, but hey, grace, right? Well, instead of saying, you know, thanks God, I can handle this one. You know, appreciate your concern, but I can handle this one. We need to recognize our sinful nature before God and recognize that grace is for the humble. It's not an entitlement for the proud. It's not something that we can call on simply as a way to cover us, because we know that we're going to sin and we know that we're going to come out of that sin. And this is just an opportunity for you, God, to show your grace again. Because where sin abounds, grace abounds more, right? Paul says, should we sin more then? Absolutely not. Grace is for the humble. It's not an entitlement for the proud. It's a blessing of a broken heart before God. A broken heart before God. Both James 4 and 1 Peter 5 state that God resists the proud but gives grace to the humble. And the Lord here says that what we do not drive out will become irritants. They'll become pricking thorns. Now, and it says in our eyes. Now, I can't imagine I mean, I looked to try and find out what that pricking thorn might be or that irritant, and it's a thorn. I mean, I can't imagine a thorn in my eye. That just is incredibly painful. But that's what he's talking about. He says it will be a thorn in your eye, and it'll also be a stake in your side. What that means is that as we continue to sin, what we see will cause us pain. What that means is our bodies will carry the constant painful reminders of the abuse that we're giving ourselves. What that means is that it says that they shall harass you in the land where you dwell. What that means is that the enemy is going to harass us and remind us of how weak and foolish and helpless we are to ever get this right. It's besetting sin. It's those things that get into our lives and simply have a grip on us. We have to agree that those are the enemy and that we're willing to drive them out. But it's also at the same time a picture of the struggles we undergo to commit to and carry out God's will. Because often, as the case is here, the odds are overwhelming. The odds are overwhelming. These guys are going to go in and they're going to be told that they need to dispossess all the inhabitants of the land and they're to destroy all these things. Well, that's hard work. That is really hard work. And so what we have to remember is, as we read through this passage, is that when the odds are overwhelming, we must constantly return to what we know that God has called us to do, even if it no longer makes sense or the resistance seems to be the stiffest. We need to remember what God has called us to do. And I know in the services, in the armed services, that you don't carry out new orders until you get new orders. You simply go back to the last thing that you heard. So unless you get new orders, you simply continue on what you're doing until the Lord has told you differently. If, of course, you're listening. That would be the other problem, is if you've cut off radio communication, then you can't get the latest orders. But that's another topic for another sermon. So as the odds are overwhelming, we constantly return to what God knew us, what God called us to do. And in this case, certainly in this case, when it comes to overcoming sin, we know that He's already given us the victory. If He has already told us to do something, then we know that eventually He's going to bring us to the success that He wants. It may not look like the success that we want, but it's going to bring us to the success that He wants, the thing that He wants to do. Going into chapter 34, we're not going to go through it at all. It's basically what it does is it lays out what the boundaries of the land is and what the divisions of the land are, east, north, south, and west. And what I can tell you is that the nation of Israel will only see those boundaries to their greatest extent during the time of David and Solomon. And we're going to find out in our study in the book of Joshua also that throughout those borders that the nation of Israel did not drive out the inhabitants. And as we continue to go through the Old Testament, we will see exactly how much of an irritation in their eyes and a stick in their flesh that this is going to be. In chapter 35 then, and starting in verse 1, "And the Lord spoke to Moses in the plains of Moab by the Jordan across from Jericho, saying, Command the children of Israel that they give the Levites cities to dwell in from the inheritance of their possession, and you shall also give the Levites common land around the cities. They shall have the cities to dwell in, and their common land shall be for their cattle, for their herds, and for all their animals. The common land of the cities which you shall give the Levites shall extend from the walls of the city around 1,000 cubits all around. And you shall measure outside the city on the east side 2,000 cubits, on the south side 2,000, on the west, and on the north. The city shall be in the middle. This shall belong to them as common land for the cities. Now among the cities which you will give to the Levites, you shall appoint 6 cities of refuge, to which a manslayer may flee. And to these you shall add 42 cities. So all the cities you will give to the Levites shall be 48. These you shall give with their common land. And the cities which you will give shall be from the possession of the children of Israel. From the larger tribe you shall give many, from the smaller you shall give few. Each shall give some of its cities to the Levites in proportion to the inheritance that each receives. So, a new concept here, the city of the Levites. So they're scattered among the people in 42 cities, plus there are six cities that are also cities of refuge, which is also a new concept that we're going to be talking about. So for a total of 48 cities that these Levites are going to be spread around. So the priests would be available for teaching and to offer sacrifice in the day-to-day lives of the nation without them having to travel to a central place. Because up to this point, these 2 to 3 million people could always see the tabernacle. They could always see the pillar above the tabernacle, and they knew exactly where to go for these daily sacrifices. Now they're talking about being spread out over a land span about the size of New Jersey. And so it's going to be kind of tough to get to the temple for daily sacrifice, or even on an annual basis, it's going to be a little bit of a hardship. So the Lord took these priests and they set them out among the people so they would be able to be there for teaching and for the sacrifices. The tabernacle obviously would be in a single place. Inevitably, that place would be Jerusalem, and everybody else is going to be scattered throughout the land. So what the tribe of Levi is seeing was a chastening from his father Jacob on Jacob's deathbed. It said, Levi, because you were so cruel, you will be scattered throughout the land. Well, the Lord took that chastening and turned it into a blessing. Because of Levi's, because of his zealousness, the tribe of Levi's zealousness during the time of the golden calf, when Moses said, who's willing to stand with me against this godlessness? And the tribe of Levi stood up and with Moses and put to death those people who were responsible for the golden calf. So the Lord took this deathbed chastening and he turned it in his grace into a blessing. So much like what he does in our lives. He turns so many things, so many trashy things in our lives into absolute blessings. That doesn't just justify the sin, but it certainly shows the grace. It certainly shows the nature of the God that we serve. We too, according to Hebrews, are priests and should be scattered among the people. My question to you is, are you available to the people around you to answer questions? Are you available to the people around you to offer sacrifice? Whether that sacrifice sometimes is in kindnesses, sometimes in the incense of prayer. Are you that priest among the people, scattered among the people? I'm currently reading a book called Falling in Love with Prayer by Mike McIntosh, who is the senior pastor at Horizon Fellowship in San Diego. And it's encouraged me to be more willing to pray at the moment instead of offering to pray. As if some magic has to occur outside of the area, you know, well, let me go into my secret room and I'll pray for you there. But to actually, as somebody brings that concern to me, then I will be willing to pray right there, whether it's in the middle of traffic or whether it's in the middle of my office. And I was deeply convicted as I was reading this. There's a gentleman at work whose wife was in an accident, I don't know, probably 4 weeks ago, totaled the van. Or maybe, no, the issue was that it was supposed to be totaled, or he thought it was supposed to be totaled, and they were going to fix it. So all of a sudden, this guy's stuck with his van that he thinks is, like, way below market. And being the appropriate capitalist that he is, he's really frustrated about every dollar he can get. And so, but I know the guy to be a Christian, or at least I know the guy to be going to church on a pretty regular basis. And he had volunteered to me that in this frustration of the accident, he also needs to go to the doctor now to check because he's having these chest pains. You know, and I'm thinking, dude, you're taking this way too seriously. You know, I can appreciate, trying to be a frugal guy, but man, you gotta let that one go. However, the Lord was prompting me to get up and say, you know what, let's pray. And I didn't. I did not. And as I read this, I was so convicted that I need to be that priest. I need to be that guy in the marketplace that is willing to pray with these people. Just, you know what, I don't care if you're a believer or not, I'm going to offer it to you. If you're coming to me and asking me to pray, you know what, I think I'm going to take you, escort you to the throne room instead of me going on your behalf. I would really encourage you to not follow me in this case, but to follow Christ and to do what He calls us to do. Verse 9. Then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, speak to the children of Israel and say to them, when you cross the Jordan into the land of Canaan, then you shall appoint cities to be cities of refuge for you, that the manslayer who kills any person accidentally may flee there. They shall be cities of refuge for you from the avenger, that the manslayer may not die until he stands before the congregation in judgment. And of the cities which you give, you shall have 6 cities of refuge. You shall appoint 3 cities on this side of the Jordan, 3 cities you shall appoint in the land of Canaan, which will be cities of refuge. These 6 cities shall be for refuge for the children of Israel, for the stranger, and for the sojourner among them, that anyone who kills a person accidentally may flee there. But if he strikes him with an iron implement so that he dies, he is a murderer. The murderer shall surely be put to death. He strikes him with a stone in the hand by which one could die, and he does die, he is a murderer. The murderer shall surely be put to death. Or if he strikes him with a wooden hand weapon by which one could die, and he does die, he is a murderer. The murderer shall surely be put to death. The avenger of blood himself shall put the murderer to death. When he meets him, he shall put him to death. If he pushes him out of hatred, or while lying in wait, hurls something at him so that he dies, or an enmity, he strikes him with his hand so that he dies, the one who struck him shall surely be put to death. He is a murderer. The avenger of blood shall put the murderer to death when he meets him. However, if he pushes him suddenly without enmity, or throws anything at him without lying in wait, or uses a stone by which a man could die, throwing it at him without seeing him so that he dies while he was not his enemy or seeking his harm, then the congregation shall judge between the manslayer and the avenger of blood according to these judgments. So the congregation shall deliver the manslayer from the hand of the avenger of blood, and the congregation shall return him to the city of refuge where he had fled, and he shall remain there until the death of the high priest who was anointed with the holy oil. But if the manslayer at any time goes outside the limits of the city of refuge where he fled, and the avenger of blood finds him outside the limits of a city of refuge, and the avenger of blood kills the manslayer, he shall not be guilty of blood, because he should have remained in the city of refuge until the death of the high priest. But after the death of the high priest, the manslayer may return to the land of his possession. These things shall be a statute of judgment to you throughout your generation in all your dwellings. Whoever kills a person, the murderer shall be put to death on the testimony of witnesses. But one witness is not sufficient testimony against a person for the death penalty. Moreover, you shall take no ransom for the life of a murderer who is guilty of death, but he shall surely be put to death. And you shall take no ransom for him who has fled to a city of refuge, that he may return to dwell in the land before the death of the priest. So you shall not pollute the land where you are, for blood defiles the land, and no atonement can be made for the land for the blood that is shed on it, except by the blood of him who shed it. Therefore, do not defile the land which you inhabit, in the midst of which I dwell, for I, the Lord, dwell among the children of Israel. No police force, no criminal justice system. The obligation of the avenger was to avenge the death of a family member. If you kill somebody in my family, I have no choice but to kill you. I would be without honor if that death was not avenged. God was not advocating that practice, but it was so ingrained in the nation of Israel, certainly so ingrained in the entire Middle Eastern area, that He was controlling it. What the cities of refuge did was it gave opportunities for the facts to be sorted out. So if, you know, you're in your field and all of a sudden, you know, your axe head flies off the handle and your neighbor just happens to be in the right place at the wrong time, and there you go. I can flee to the city of refuge and wait for all the facts to be sorted out, for the elders to come and let them know, look, I was just in my field working. You know, I had nothing against this man. And so it was an accidental death. So then I have the ability to stay in that city of refuge for as long as it says as the high priest died. So it gives an opportunity for the facts to be sorted out. But it says a murderer was to be put to the death by the hand of the avenger. We're to turn that guy over if it in fact is found to be murder, but only on the testimony of more than one witness. So God is saying, I want this controlled. I want this controlled. Now, this is still the mindset of the Middle Eastern world. This is why it is such a powder keg even today. It is something we failed to grasp in the Western world and will continue to be a problem long after we leave. That as long as blood is shed, there is a need for vengeance, and there will be an avenger. As long as there are the Palestinian alive, Israel's in danger. As long as there's an Israelite alive, Palestine is in danger. Iraq, all of these things are still operating under the same mindset that you shed the blood of my family, I have no choice. So this is still very much something that we see. And I hope that gives you an understanding of the type of world that they were living in the Old Testament. It is very much alive today. So these cities of refuge, so that which was just done accidentally provides a place of grace and mercy as long as they live under the protection of the city. And then that statute of limitations, if you will, runs out at the death of the high priest. So as soon as the high priest dies, then you're welcome to leave that city and go back to your original land. And just as in the sacrificial system that God set up, you'll see here that there's no remedy for deliberate sin except death. In the sacrificial system, there was no sacrifice for deliberate sin. It was only the accidental sin. It was only the things that we stumbled upon as opposed to deliberately considered and acted out. And here too, God says there is no remedy for that. There is nothing that can be done from a sacrificial standpoint. There's no refuge. You will die. If you kill a man, you will die. And he even goes so far as to say, to make sure that there is no confusion about it, he says that there is no atonement that can be made for the land for the blood that is shed on it except by the blood of him who shed it. Makes that very, very clear. However, in 1 John 1:6, it says, if we say that we have fellowship with him and walk in darkness, we lie and do not practice the truth. If we are so set on sin, there is no remedy for us either. That is something that we have to be aware of. If we are so set on sin, it says here, but if we say we have fellowship with him and we walk in darkness, we lie and we do not practice the truth. We are not walking in fellowship with him if our desire is towards sin. But it says here that these cities were cities of refuge, and they present a wonderful picture of Christ. A wonderful picture of Christ. So these guys were safe as long as they stayed in the city. Now if they strayed out, they could be killed. If they left the city, they were outside of that protection, and the avenger of blood could easily kill them and not be held guilty. We are to stay in the refuge of Jesus at all times. At all times. In Romans 8:1, it says, "There is therefore now no condemnation to those who are in Christ Jesus, who do not walk according to the flesh, but according to the Spirit." Man, as long as I'm staying there, as long as I'm staying in that city of refuge, as long as I'm staying in Jesus, the Avenger can't get me. And He being our High Priest, He will never die. Nor should we ever leave. Because just outside of that refuge, He's waiting. Sometimes patiently waiting for us to step right outside of that city gate, and He'll nail us every time. Because that Avenger is the enemy of our souls. And we should agree to make our lives there in that city of refuge instead of pining for going back to that possession, because we know that our High Priest is never going to die, so we're never going to go back to that possession. So instead of thinking about back there where we live, man, let's just make a life right here in the city of God, in the refuge of Jesus Christ. Because our possession before running into that refuge was a life of sin and a life of death. Well, you say, "Well, Brian, that's all very good, but I haven't committed murder recently." Thought about it a few times. But I haven't committed murder intentionally or unintentionally. If you would turn with me to Matthew chapter 5. Starting in verse 20. It says, "For I say to you that unless your righteousness exceeds the righteousness of the scribes and Pharisees, you will by no means enter the kingdom of heaven. You have heard that it was said to those of old, 'You shall not murder,' and whoever murders will be in danger of the judgment. But I say to you that whoever is angry with his brother without a cause shall be in danger of the judgment. And whoever says to his brother, 'Raka,' shall be in danger of the council. But whoever says, 'You fool,' shall be in danger of hellfire. Therefore, if you bring your gift to the altar, and there remember that your brother has something against you, leave your gift there before the altar and go your way. First be reconciled to your brother, and then come and offer your gift. Agree with your adversary quickly while you are on your way with him, lest your adversary deliver you to the judge hand you over to the officer, and you be thrown into prison. Assuredly, I say to you, you will by no means get out of there until you have paid the last penny." So Jesus raises the standard. "I haven't committed murder recently." Well, it says here, if you've been angry, then you've done so. So what is our right thing to do but to run into that refuge of Jesus? In chapter 36, we went over when we talked about Numbers 27. It's about the daughters of Zelophehad. And just for your memory's sake, that was the division of the land. These five daughters of Zelophehad had no man in the family to accept that possession. So they went to Moses and said that we really don't think that that's the right thing. Can we reconsider? And Moses did the right thing. He went before the Lord and said, "You're absolutely right. God said that you're to give the possession." Well, elders of the land came up and said, "You know, there's a problem here, because if any of those women marry into another family, another tribe, then that land goes with them. So all of a sudden you've got, you know, the tribe of Gad over here, and there's a big hole over here in one of the lands of Judah, because this woman married over there." Well, he said, "All right, you need to stay in your own tribe. Make sure that you marry into your own tribe. There's plenty of people there. You can find a man there." I would encourage any of you single folks to look at that as further representation of when God tells us not to be unequally yoked. That we really need to consider the fact that we have a possession, the promised land. We have our life in Jesus. And if we marry outside of that, if we consider things outside of that, then it really does cause a problem. So, again, we've taught on that just recently, and so I won't belabor that point. But as evidenced by the last two chapters, our God is not a God of vengeance on His children, nor does He create laws without love. When the Lord first appeared to Moses, he referred to himself as the I Am, or the Becoming One. And he is always what we need. He is always what we need. In this case, that city of refuge when we become overwhelmed by the world, committing murder in our hearts, as Jesus just described it. Now, we don't often lie in wait to take vengeance when we've been wronged. Sometimes we do. But neither do we react with love instead of anger and hatred. So we run straight into the welcoming arms of Jesus. And He'll greet us at the gate, and He'll welcome us to stay there. So we do for a while, and then we venture back out, in danger of being overtaken again by the avenger. When the Lord showed His glory to Moses, it was not a great display of power manipulation. He said, I will make my goodness pass before you. I will proclaim the name of the Lord before you. And He then proceeded to reveal Himself as, I am. I am your God. Merciful and gracious, long-suffering and abounding in goodness and truth, keeping mercy for thousands, forgiving iniquity and transgression and sin, by no means clearing the guilty, visiting the iniquity of the fathers upon the children and the children's children to the third and fourth generation. Guys, by the way, there's your Father's Day message. The Lord has shown His glory to us today, providing us with direction for every step of the way, being intimately interested in our lives, reminding us of the idols and images we are to utterly destroy in our lives as we possess that which has been promised. A life in Jesus, walking in the Spirit. He has given us instruction that we as His priests have our inheritance among the people and should be there in our workplaces, in our neighborhoods, and in our schools. Yet He has also shown us His glory and His mercy and His grace. When we fall, He is our merciful judge. See, our judge is also our refuge.